gently attempted. Their execution would have vivified the empire, and more cost and labor were often wasted in the structure of a cathedral. If we retrace the outlines of this geographical picture, it will be seen that the empire of the Franks extended, between east and west, from the Ebro to the Elbe or Vistula, between the north and south, from the Duchy of Beneventum to the River Eider, the perpetual boundary of Germany and Denmark. The personal and political importance of Charlemagne was magnified by the distress and division of the rest of Europe. The islands of Great Britain and Ireland were disputed by a crowd of princes of Saxon or Scottish origin, and after the loss of Spain, the Christian and Gothic kingdom of Alfonso the Chaste was confined to the narrow range of the Asturian mountains. These petty sovereigns revered the power or virtue of the Carlovingian monarch, implored the honour and support of his alliance, and styled him their common parent, the sole and supreme emperor of the West. He maintained a more equal intercourse with the caliph Harun al-Rashid, whose dominion stretched from Africa to India, and accepted from his ambassadors a tent, a water clock, an elephant, and the keys of the Holy Sepulchre. It is not easy to conceive the private friendship of a Frank and an Arab, who were strangers to each other's person and language and religion. But their public correspondence was founded on vanity, and their remote situation left no room for a competition of interest. Two-thirds of the Western Empire of Rome was subject to Charlemagne, and the deficiency was amply supplied by his command of the inaccessible or invincible nations of Germany. But in the choice of his enemies, we may be reasonably surprised that he so often preferred the poverty of the north to the riches of the south. The 33 campaigns laboriously consumed in the woods and morasses of Germany would have sufficed to assert the amplitude of his title by the expulsion of the Greeks from Italy and the Saracens from Spain. The weakness of the Greeks would have ensured an easy victory, and the Holy Crusade against the Saracens would have been prompted by glory and revenge, and loudly justified by religion and policy. Perhaps in his expeditions beyond the Rhine and the Elbe, he aspired to save his monarchy from the fate of the Roman Empire, to disarm the enemies of civilized society, and to eradicate the seed of future immigrations. But it has been wisely observed that in a light of precaution, all conquest must be ineffectual unless it could be universal, since the increasing circle must be involved in a larger sphere of hostility. The subjugation of Germany withdrew the veil which had so long concealed the continent or islands of Scandinavia from the knowledge of Europe, and awakened the torpid courage of their barbarous natives. The fiercest of the Saxon idolaters escaped from the Christian tyrant to their brethren of the north. The ocean and Mediterranean were covered with their piratical fleets, and Charlemagne beheld with a sigh the destructive progress of the Normans, who in less than 70 years precipitated the fall of his race and monarchy. Had the Pope and the Romans revived the primitive constitution, the titles of Emperor and Augustus were conferred on Charlemagne for the term of his life, and his successors on each vacancy must have ascended the throne by formal or tacit election. But the association of his son Louis the Pious asserts the independent right of monarchy and conquest, and the emperor seems on this occasion to have foreseen and prevented the latent claims of the clergy. The royal youth was commanded to take the crown from the altar, and with his own hands to place it on his head as a gift which he held from God, his father, and the nation. The same ceremony was repeated, though with less energy, in the subsequent associations of Lothair and Louis II. The Carlovingian scepter was transmitted from father to son in a lineal descent of 4 generations, and the ambition of the popes was reduced to the empty honour of crowning and anointing these hereditary princes, who were already invested with their power and dominions. The pious Louis survived his brothers and embraced the whole empire of Charlemagne. But the nations and the nobles, his bishops and his children, quickly discerned that this mighty mass was no longer inspired by the same soul, and the foundations were undermined to the center, while the external surface was yet fair and entire. After a war or battle which consumed 100,000 francs, the empire was divided by treaty between his three sons, who had violated every filial and fraternal duty. The kingdoms of Germany and France were forever separated. The provinces of Gaul, between the Rhone and the Alps, the Meuse and the Rhine, were assigned with Italy to the imperial dignity of Lothair. In the partition of his share, Lorraine and Arles, two recent and transitory kingdoms, were bestowed on the younger children, and Louis II, his eldest son, was content with the realm of Italy, the proper and sufficient patrimony of a Roman emperor. On his death, without any male issue, the vacant throne was disputed by his uncles and cousins, and the popes most dexterously seized the occasion of judging the claims and merits of the candidates, and of bestowing on the most obsequious or most liberal the imperial office of advocate of the Roman Church. The dregs of the Carlovingian race no longer exhibited any symptoms of virtue or power, and the ridiculous epithets of the bard, the stammerer, the fat, and the simple distinguished the tame and uniform features of a crowd of kings alike deserving of oblivion. By the failure of the collateral branches, the whole inheritance devolved to Charles the Fat, the last emperor of his family. His insanity authorized the desertion of Germany, Italy, and France. He was deposed in a diet and solicited his daily bread from the rebels by whose contempt his life and liberty had been spared. According to the measure of their force, the governors, the bishops, and the lords usurped the fragments of the falling empire, and some preference was shown to the female or illegitimate blood of Charlemagne. Of the greater part, the title and possession were alike doubtful, and the merit was adequate to the contracted sale of their dominions. Those who could appear with an army at the gates of Rome were crowned emperors in the Vatican, but their modesty was more frequently satisfied with the appellation of kings of Italy, and the whole term of 74 years may be deemed a vacancy from the abdication of Charles the Fat to the establishment of Otho the First. Between the Rhine, the Rhone, and the Alps, the successors of Otho acquired a vain supremacy over the broken kingdoms of Burgundy and Arles. In the north, Christianity was propagated by the sword of Otho, the conqueror and apostle of the Slavic nations of the Elbe and Oder. The marches of Brandenburg and Schleswig were fortified with German colonies, and the King of Denmark, the Dukes of Poland and Bohemia, confessed themselves his tributary vassals. At the head of a victorious army, he passed the Alps, subdued the Kingdom of Italy, delivered the Pope, and forever fixed the imperial crown in the name and nation of Germany. From that memorable era, two maxims of public jurisprudence were introduced by force and ratified by time. That the prince who was elected in the German Diet acquired from that instant the subject kingdoms of Italy and Rome, but that he might not legally assume the titles of Emperor and Augustus till he had received the crown from the hands of the Roman pontiff. The imperial dignity of Charlemagne was announced to the East by the alteration of his style, and instead of saluting his fathers, the Greek emperors, he presumed to adopt the more equal and familiar appellation of brother. Perhaps in his connection with Irene he aspired to the name of husband. His embassy to Constantinople spoke the language of peace and friendship, and might conceal a treaty of marriage with that ambitious princess who had renounced the most sacred duties of a mother. The nature, the duration, the probable consequences of such a union between two distant and dissonant empires, it is impossible to conjecture. But the unanimous silence of the Latins may teach us to suspect that the report was invented by the enemies of Irene, to charge her with the guilt of betraying the church and state to the strangers of the West. The French ambassadors were the spectators, and had nearly been the victims of the conspiracy of Nicephorus and the national hatred. Constantinople was exasperated by the treason and sacrilege of ancient Rome. A proverb that the Franks were good friends and bad neighbors was in everyone's mouth, but it was dangerous to provoke a neighbor who might be tempted to reiterate in the Church of Santa Sophia the ceremony of his imperial coronation. After a tedious journey of circuit and delay, the ambassadors of Nicephorus found him in his camp on the banks of the river Sala, and Charlemagne affected to confound their vanity by displaying, in a Franconian village, the pomp, or at least the pride, of the Byzantine palace. The Greeks were successively led through four halls of audience. In the first they were ready to fall prostrate before a splendid personage in a chair of state, till he informed them that he was only a servant, the constable or master of the horse of the emperor. The same mistake and the same answer were repeated in the apartments of the Count Palatine, the steward, and the chamberlain, and their impatience was gradually heightened till the doors of the presence chamber were thrown open, and they beheld the genuine monarch on his throne, enriched with the foreign luxury which he despised, and encircled with the love and reverence of his victorious chiefs. A treaty of peace and alliance was concluded between the two empires, and the limits of the East and West were defined by the right of present possession. But the Greeks soon forgot this humiliating equality, or remembered it only to hate the barbarians by whom it was extorted. During the short union of virtue and power, they respectfully saluted the august Charlemagne with the acclamations of Basileus and Emperor of the Romans. As soon as these qualities were separated in the person of his pious son, the Byzantine letters were inscribed, "To the king, or, as he styles himself, the emperor of the Franks and Lombards." When both power and virtue were extinct, they despoiled Louis II of his hereditary title, and with the barbarous appellation of Rex, or Riga, degraded him among the crowd of Latin princes. His reply is expressive of his weakness. He proves, with some learning, that both in sacred and profane history, the name of king is synonymous with the Greek word basileus. If, at Constantinople, it were assumed in a more exclusive and imperial sense, he claims from his ancestors and from the popes a just participation of the honors of the Roman purple. The same controversy was revived in the reign of the Othos, and their ambassador describes in lively colors the insolence of the Byzantine court. The Greeks affected to despise the poverty and ignorance of the Franks and Saxons, and in their last decline refused to prostitute to the kings of Germany the title of Roman emperors. These emperors, in the election of the popes, continued to exercise the powers which had been assumed by the Gothic and Grecian princes, and the importance of this prerogative increased with the temporal estate and spiritual jurisdiction of the Roman Church. In the Christian aristocracy, the principal members of the clergy still formed a senate to assist the administration and to supply the vacancy of the bishop. Rome was divided into 28 parishes, and each parish was governed by a cardinal priest or praetor, a title which, however common or modest in its origin, has aspired to emulate the purple of kings. Their number was enlarged by the association of the 7 deacons of the most considerable hospitals, the 7 Palatine judges of the Lateran, and some dignitaries of the church. This ecclesiastical senate was directed by the 7 cardinal bishops of the Roman province, who were less occupied in the suburb dioceses of Ostia, Porto, Velitrae, Tusculum, Praeneste, Tibur, and the Sabines, than by their weekly service in the Lateran and their superior share in the honours and authority of the apostolic see. On the death of the Pope, these bishops recommended a successor to the suffrage of the College of Cardinals, and their choice was ratified or rejected by the applause or clamour of the Roman people. But the election was imperfect, nor could the pontiff be legally consecrated till the emperor, the advocate of the church, had graciously signified his approbation and consent. The royal commissioner examined on the spot the form and freedom of the proceedings. Nor was it till after a previous scrutiny into the qualifications of the candidates that he accepted an oath of fidelity and confirmed the donations which had successively enriched the patrimony of St. Peter. In the frequent schisms, the rival claims were submitted to the sentence of the emperor, and in a synod of bishops, he presumed to judge, to condemn, and to punish the crimes of a guilty pontiff. Otho the First imposed a treaty on the Senate and people who engaged to prefer the candidate most acceptable to his majesty. His successors anticipated or prevented their choice. They bestowed the Roman benefice, like the bishoprics of Cologne or Bamberg, on their chancellors or preceptors, and whatever might be the merit of a Frank or Saxon, his name sufficiently attests the interposition of foreign power. These acts of prerogative were most speciously excused by the vices of a popular election. The competitor, who had been excluded by the cardinals, appealed to the passions or avarice of the multitude. The Vatican and the Lateran were stained with blood, and the most powerful senators, the Marquises of Tuscany and the Counts of Tusculum, held the apostolic see in a long and disgraceful servitude. The Roman pontiffs of the 9th and 10th centuries were insulted, imprisoned, and murdered by their tyrants, and such was their indigence after the loss and usurpation of the ecclesiastical patrimonies that they could neither support the state of a prince nor exercise the charity of a priest. The influence of 2 sister prostitutes, Maritia and Theodora, was founded on their wealth and beauty, their political and amorous intrigues. The most strenuous of their lovers were rewarded with the Roman mitre, and their reign may have suggested to the darker ages the fable of a female pope. The bastard son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of Maritia, a rare genealogy, were seated in the chair of St. Peter, and it was at the age of 19 years that the second of these became the head of the Latin Church. His youth and manhood were of a suitable complexion, and the nations of pilgrims could bear testimony to the charges that were urged against him in a Roman synod and in the presence of Otho the Great. As John the 12th had renounced the dress and decencies of his profession, the soldier may not perhaps be dishonored by the wine which he drank, the blood that he spilt, the flames that he kindled, or the licentious pursuits of gaming and hunting. His open simony might be the consequence of distress, and his blasphemous invocation of Jupiter and Venus, if it be true, could not possibly be serious. But we read with some surprise that the worthy grandson of Maritia lived in public adultery with the matrons of Rome, that the Lateran palace was turned into a school for prostitution, and that his rapes of virgins and widows had deterred the female pilgrims from visiting the tomb of St. Peter, lest, in the devout act, they should be violated by his successor. The Protestants have dwelt with malicious pleasure on these characters of Antichrist, but to a philosophic eye, the vices of the clergy are far less dangerous than their virtues. After a long series of scandal, the apostolic see was reformed and exalted by the austerity and zeal of Gregory the 7th. That ambitious monk devoted his life to the execution of two projects. To fix in the College of Cardinals the freedom and independence of election, and forever to abolish the right or usurpation of the emperors and the Roman people. To bestow and resume the Western Empire as a fief or benefice of the Church, and to extend his temporal dominion over the kings and kingdoms of the earth. After a contest of 50 years, the first of these designs was accomplished by the firm support of the ecclesiastical order, whose liberty was connected with that of their chief. But the second attempt, though it was crowned with some partial and apparent success, has been vigorously resisted by the secular power, and finally extinguished by the improvement of human reason. In the revival of the Empire of Rome, neither the bishop nor the people could bestow on Charlemagne or Otho the provinces which were lost, as they had been won by the chance of arms. But the Romans were free to choose a master for themselves, and the powers which had been delegated to the patrician were irrevocably granted to the French and Saxon emperors of the West. The broken records of the times preserved some remembrance of their palace, their mint, their tribunal, their edicts, and the sword of justice, which, as late as the 13th century, was derived from Caesar to the prefect of the city. Between the arts of the popes and the violence of the people, this supremacy was crushed and annihilated. Content with the titles of Emperor and Augustus, the successors of Charlemagne neglected to assert this local jurisdiction. In the hour of prosperity, their ambition was diverted by more alluring objects, and in the decay and division of the empire, they were oppressed by the defense of their hereditary provinces. Amidst the ruins of Italy, the famous Maurizia invited one of the usurpers to assume the character of her third husband, and Hugh, King of Burgundy, was introduced by her faction into the mole of Hadrian, or Castle of Sant'Angelo, which commands the principal bridge and entrance of Rome. Her son, by the first marriage, Alberic, was compelled to attend at the nuptial banquet, but his reluctant and ungraceful service was chastised with a blow by his new father. The blow was productive of a revolution. "Romans," exclaimed the youth, "once you were the masters of the world, and these Burgundians the most abject of your slaves. They now reign, these voracious and brutal savages, and my injury is the commencement of your servitude." The alarum bell rang to arms in every quarter of the city. The Burgundians retreated with haste and shame. Maurizia was imprisoned by her victorious son, and his brother, Pope John the 11th, was reduced to the exercise of his spiritual functions. With the title of prince, Alberic possessed above 20 years the government of Rome, and he is said to have gratified the popular prejudice by restoring the office, or at least the title, of consuls and tribunes. His son and heir, Octavian, assumed, with the pontificate, the name of John the 12th. Like his predecessor, he was provoked by the Lombard princes to seek a deliverer for the Church and Republic, and the services of Otho were rewarded with the imperial dignity. But the Saxon was imperious. The Romans were impatient. The festival of the coronation was disturbed by the secret conflict of prerogative and freedom, and Otho commanded his sword-bearer not to stir from his person, lest he should be assaulted and murdered at the foot of the altar. Before he repassed the Alps, the emperor chastised the revolt of the people and the ingratitude of John the 12th. The pope was degraded in a synod. The prefect was mounted on an ass, whipped through the city, and cast into a dungeon. 13 of the most guilty were hanged. Others were mutilated or banished, and this severe process was justified by the ancient laws of Theodosius and Justinian. The voice of fame has accused the second Otho of a perfidious and bloody act, the massacre of the senators, whom he had invited to his table under the fair semblance of hospitality and friendship. In the minority of his son, Otho III, Rome made a bold attempt to shake off the Saxon yoke, and the consul Crescentius was the Brutus of the Republic. From the condition of a subject and an exile, he twice rose to the command of the city, oppressed, expelled, and created the popes, and formed a conspiracy for restoring the authority of the Greek emperors. In the fortress of St. Angela, he maintained an obstinate siege till the unfortunate consul was betrayed by a promise of safety. His body was suspended on a gibbet, and his head was exposed on the battlements of the castle. By reverse of fortune, Otho, after separating his troops, was besieged 3 days without food in his palace, and a disgraceful escape saved him from the justice or fury of the Romans. The senator Ptolemy was the leader of the people, and the widow of Crescentius enjoyed the pleasure of the fame of revenging her husband by poison which she administered to her imperial lover. It was the design of Otho III to abandon the ruder countries of the north, to erect his throne in Italy, and to revive the institutions of the Roman monarchy. But his successors only once in their lives appeared on the banks of the Tiber to receive their crown in the Vatican. Their absence was contemptible, their presence odious and formidable. They descended from the Alps at the head of their barbarians, who were strangers and enemies to the country, and their transient visit was a scene of tumult and bloodshed. A faint remembrance of their ancestors still tormented the Romans, and they beheld with pious indignation the succession of Saxons, Franks, Swabians, and Bohemians, who usurped the purple and prerogatives of the Caesars. There is nothing perhaps more adverse to nature and reason than to hold in obedience remote countries and foreign nations in opposition to their inclination and interest. A torrent of barbarians may pass over the earth, but an extensive empire must be supported by a refined system of policy and oppression. In the center, an absolute power, prompt in action and rich in resources, a swift and easy communication with the extreme parts, fortifications to check the first effort of rebellion, a regular administration to protect and punish, and a well-disciplined army to inspire fear without provoking discontent and despair. Far different was the situation of the German Caesars, who were ambitious to enslave the kingdom of Italy. Their patrimonial estates were stretched along the Rhine or scattered in the provinces, but this ample domain was alienated by the imprudence or distress of successive princes, and their revenue, from minute and vexatious prerogative, was scarcely sufficient for the maintenance of their household. Their troops were formed by the legal or voluntary service of their feudal vassals, who passed the Alps with reluctance, assumed the license of rapine and disorder, and capriciously deserted before the end of the campaign. Whole armies were swept away by the pestilential influence of the climate. The survivors brought back the bones of their princes and nobles, and the effects of their own intemperance were often imputed to the treachery and malice of the Italians, who rejoiced at least in the calamities of the barbarians. This irregular tyranny might contend on equal terms with the petty tyrants of Italy, nor can the people, or the reader, be much interested in the event of the quarrel. But in the 11th and 12th centuries the Lombards rekindled the flame of industry and freedom, and the generous example was at length imitated by the republics of Tuscany. In the Italian cities a municipal government had never been totally abolished, and their first privileges were granted by the favor and policy of the emperors, who were desirous of erecting a plebeian barrier against the independence of the nobles. But their rapid progress, the daily extension of their power and pretensions, were founded on the numbers and spirit of these rising communities. Each city filled the measure of her diocese or district, the jurisdiction of the counts and bishops, of the marquises and counts, was banished from the land, and the proudest nobles were persuaded or compelled to desert their solitary castles and to embrace the more honourable character of freemen and magistrates. The legislative authority was inherent in the General Assembly, but the executive powers were entrusted to three consuls, annually chosen from the three orders of captains, valvassors, and commons into which the Republic was divided. Under the protection of equal law, the labors of agriculture and commerce were gradually revived. But the martial spirit of the Lombards was nourished by the presence of danger, and as often as the bell was rung or the standard erected, the gates of the city poured forth a numerous and intrepid band, whose zeal in their own cause was soon guided by the use and discipline of arms. At the foot of these popular ramparts, the pride of the Caesars was overthrown, and the invincible genius of liberty prevailed over the two Fredericks, the greatest princes of the Middle Age, the first, superior perhaps in military prowess, the second, who undoubtedly excelled in the softer accomplishments of peace and learning. Ambitious of restoring the splendor of the purple, Frederick I invaded the republics of Lombardy with the arts of a statesman, the valor of a soldier, and the cruelty of a tyrant. The recent discovery of the Pandects had renewed a science most favorable to despotism, and his venal advocates proclaimed the emperor the absolute master of the lives and properties of his subjects. His royal prerogatives, in a less odious sense, were acknowledged in the Diet of Roncaglia, and the revenue of Italy was fixed at 30,000 pounds of silver, which were multiplied to an indefinite demand by the rapine of the fiscal officers. The obstinate cities were reduced by the terror or the force of his arms. His captives were delivered to the executioner or shot from his military engines. And after the siege and surrender of Milan, the buildings of that stately capital were razed to the ground. 300 hostages were sent into Germany, and the inhabitants were dispersed in 4 villages under the yoke of the inflexible conqueror. But Milan soon rose from her ashes, and the League of Lombardy was cemented by distress. Their cause was espoused by Venice, Pope Alexander III, and the Greek Emperor. The fabric of oppression was overturned in a day, and in the Treaty of Constance, Frederick subscribed, with some reservations, the freedom of 24 cities. His grandson contended with their vigor and maturity, but Frederick II was endowed with some personal and peculiar advantages. His birth and education recommended him to the Italians, and in the implacable discord of the two factions, the Ghibellines were attached to the emperor, while the Guelphs displayed the banner of liberty and the church. The court of Rome had slumbered when his father Henry VI was permitted to unite with the empire the kingdoms of Naples and Sicily, and from these hereditary realms the son derived an ample and ready supply of troops and treasure. Yet Frederick II was finally oppressed by the arms of the Lombards and the thunders of the Vatican. His kingdom was given to a stranger, and the last of his family was beheaded at Naples on a public scaffold. During 60 years, no emperor appeared in Italy, and the name was remembered only by the ignominious sale of the last relics of sovereignty. The barbarian conquerors of the West were pleased to decorate their chief with the title of emperor, but it was not their design to invest him with the despotism of Constantine and Justinian. The persons of the Germans were free, their conquests were their own, and their national character was animated by a spirit which scorned the servile jurisprudence of the new or the ancient Rome. It would have been a vain and dangerous attempt to impose a monarch on the armed freemen who were impatient of a magistrate, on the bold who refused to obey, on the powerful who aspired to command. The empire of Charlemagne and Otho was distributed among the dukes of the nations or provinces, the counts of the smaller districts, and the Margraves of the Marches or Frontiers, who all united the civil and military authority as it had been delegated to the lieutenants of the first Caesars. The Roman governors, who for the most part were soldiers of fortune, seduced their mercenary legions, assumed the imperial purple, and either failed or succeeded in their revolt without wounding the power and unity of government. If the dukes, margraves, and counts of Germany were less audacious in their claims, the consequences of their success were more lasting and pernicious to the state. Instead of aiming at the supreme rank, they silently labored to establish and appropriate their provincial independence. Their ambition was seconded by the weight of their estates and vassals, their mutual example and support, the common interest of the subordinate nobility, the change of princes and families, the minorities of Otho III and Henry IV, the ambition of the popes, and the vain pursuit of the fugitive crowns of Italy and Rome. All the attributes of regal and territorial jurisdiction were gradually usurped by the commanders of the provinces. The right of peace and war, of life and death, of coinage and taxation, of foreign alliance and domestic economy. Whatever had been seized by violence was ratified by favor or distress, was granted as the price of a doubtful vote or a voluntary service. Whatever had been granted to one could not, without injury, be denied to his successor or equal. And every act of local or temporary possession was insensibly molded into the constitution of the Germanic kingdom. In every province, the visible presence of the duke or count was interposed between the throne and the nobles. The subjects of the law became the vassals of a private chief, and the standard which he received from his sovereign was often raised against him in the field. The temporal power of the clergy was cherished and exalted by the superstition or policy of the Carlovingian and Saxon dynasties, who blindly depended on their moderation and fidelity. And the bishoprics of Germany were made equal in extent and privilege, superior in wealth and population, to the most ample states of the military order. As long as the emperors retained the prerogative of bestowing on every vacancy these ecclesiastic and secular benefices, their cause was maintained by the gratitude or ambition of their friends and favorites. But in the quarrel of the investitures they were deprived of their influence over the episcopal chapters. The freedom of election was restored, and the sovereign was reduced by solemn mockery to his first prayers, the recommendation, once in his reign, to a single prebend on each church. The secular governors, instead of being recalled at the will of a superior, could be degraded only by the sentence of their peers. In the first age of the monarchy, the appointment of the son to the duchy or county of his father was solicited as a favor. It was gradually obtained as a custom and extorted as a right. The lineal succession was often extended to the collateral or female branches. The states of the empire, their popular and at length their legal appellation, were divided and alienated by testament and sale, and all idea of a public trust was lost in that of a private and perpetual inheritance. The emperor could not even be enriched by the casualties of forfeiture and extinction. Within the term of a year, he was obliged to dispose of the vacant fief, and in the choice of the candidate, it was his duty to consult either the general or the provincial diet. After the death of Frederick II, Germany was left a monster with 100 heads. A crowd of princes and prelates disputed the ruins of the empire. The lords of the innumerable castles were less prone to obey than to imitate their superiors, and according to the measure of their strength, their incessant hostilities received the names of conquest or robbery. Such anarchy was the inevitable consequence of the laws and manners of Europe, and the kingdoms of France and Italy were shivered into fragments by the violence of the same tempest. but the Italian cities and the French vassals were divided and destroyed, while the union of the Germans has produced, under the name of an empire, a great system of a federative republic. In the frequent and at last the perpetual institution of diets, a national spirit was kept alive, and the powers of a common legislature are still exercised by the three branches or colleges of the electors, the princes, and the free and imperial cities of Germany. Seven of the most powerful feudatories were permitted to assume, with a distinguished name and rank, the exclusive privilege of choosing the Roman emperor, and these electors were the King of Bohemia, the Duke of Saxony, the Margrave of Brandenburg, the Count Palatine of the Rhine, and the three archbishops of Mentz, of Trier, and of Cologne. The College of Princes and Prelates purged themselves of a promiscuous multitude. They reduced to four representative votes the long series of independent counts, and excluded the nobles or equestrian order, 60,000 of whom, as in the Polish diets, had appeared on horseback in the field of election. The pride of birth and dominion, of the sword and the mitre, wisely adopted the commons as the third branch of the legislature, and in the progress of society they were introduced about the same era into the national assemblies of France, England, and Germany. The Hanseatic League commanded the trade and navigation of the north. The Confederates of the Rhine secured the peace and intercourse of the inland country. The influence of the cities has been adequate to their wealth and policy, and their negative still invalidates the acts of the two superior colleges of electors and princes. It is in the 14th century that we may view in the strongest light the state and contrast of the Roman Empire of Germany, which no longer held, except on the borders of the Rhine and Danube, a single province of Trajan or Constantine. Their unworthy successors were the counts of Habsburg, of Nassau, of Luxembourg, and Schwarzenburg. The Emperor, Henry VII, procured for his son the crown of Bohemia, and his grandson, Charles IV, was born among a people strange and barbarous in the estimation of the Germans themselves. After the excommunication of Louis of Bavaria, he received the gift or promise of the vacant empire from the Roman pontiffs, who in the exile and captivity of Avignon affected the dominion of the earth. The death of his competitors united the electoral college, and Charles was unanimously saluted King of the Romans and future emperor, a title which in the same age was prostituted to the Caesars of Germany and Greece. The German emperor was no more than the elective and impotent magistrate of an aristocracy of princes, who had not left him a village that he might call his own. His best prerogative was the right of presiding and proposing in the National Senate, which was convened at his summons, and his native kingdom of Bohemia, less opulent than the adjacent city of Nuremberg, was the firmest seat of his power and the richest source of his revenue. The army with which he passed the Alps consisted of 300 horse. In the cathedral of St. Ambrose, Charles was crowned with the Iron Crown, which tradition ascribed to the Lombard monarchy. But he was admitted only with a peaceful train. The gates of the city were shut upon him, and the King of Italy was held a captive by the arms of the Visconti, whom he confirmed in the sovereignty of Milan. In the Vatican he was once again crowned with the Golden Crown of the Empire, but in obedience to a secret treaty, the Roman Emperor immediately withdrew without reposing a single night within the walls of Rome. The eloquent Petrarch, whose fancy revived the visionary glories of the capital, deplores and upbraids the ignominious flight of the Bohemian, and even his contemporaries could observe that the sole exercise of his authority was in the lucrative sale of privileges and titles. The gold of Italy secured the election of his son. But such was the shameful poverty of the Roman emperor that his person was arrested by a butcher in the streets of Worms and was detained in the public inn as a pledge or hostage for the payment of his expenses. From this humiliating scene, let us turn to the apparent majesty of the same Charles in the diets of the empire. The golden bull, which fixes the Germanic constitution, is promulgated in the style of a sovereign and legislator. 100 princes bowed before his throne and exalted their own dignity by the voluntary honors which they yielded to their chief or minister. At the royal banquet, the hereditary great officers, the 7 electors, who in rank and title were equal to kings, performed their solemn and domestic service of the palace. The seals of the Triple Kingdom were borne in state by the archbishops of Mainz, Cologne, and Trier, the perpetual arch-chancellors of Germany, Italy, and Arles. The great marshal on horseback exercised his function with a silver measure of oats, which he emptied on the ground, and immediately dismounted to regulate the order of the guests. The great steward, the Count Palatine of the Rhine, placed the dishes on the table. The great chamberlain, the Margrave of Brandenburg, presented, after the repast, the golden ewer and basin to wash. The king of Bohemia, as great cupbearer, was represented by the emperor's brother, the Duke of Luxembourg and Brabant. And the procession was closed by the great huntsman, who introduced a boar and a stag with a loud chorus of horns and hounds. Nor was the supremacy of the emperor confined to Germany alone. The hereditary monarchs of Europe confessed the preeminence of his rank and dignity. He was the first of the Christian princes, the temporal head of the great Republic of the West. To his person the title of Majesty was long appropriated, and he disputed with the Pope the sublime prerogative of creating kings and assembling councils. The oracle of the civil law, the learned Bartolus, was a pensioner of Charles IV, and his school resounded with the doctrine that the Roman emperor was the rightful sovereign of the earth, from the rising to the setting sun. The contrary opinion was condemned, not as an error, but as a heresy, since even the gospel had pronounced, "And there went forth a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." If we annihilate the interval of time and space between Augustus and Charles, strong and striking will be the contrast between the two Caesars. The Bohemian, who concealed his weakness under the mask of ostentation, and the Roman, who disguised his strength under the semblance of modesty. At the head of his victorious legions, in his reign over the sea and land, from the Nile and Euphrates to the Atlantic Ocean, Augustus professed himself the servant of the state and the equal of his fellow citizens. The conqueror of Rome and her provinces assumed a popular and legal form of a censor, a consul, and a tribune. His will was the law of mankind, but in the declaration of his laws he borrowed the voice of the Senate and people, and from their decrees their master accepted and renewed his temporary commission to administer the Republic. In his dress, his domestics, his titles, in all the offices of social life, Augustus maintained the character of a private Roman, and his most artful flatterers respected the secret of his absolute and perpetual monarchy.
Chapter 50. Description of Arabia and its inhabitants. Birth, character, and doctrine of Muhammad. He preaches at Mecca, flies to Medina, propagates his religion by the sword. Voluntary or reluctant submission of the Arabs. His death and successors. the claims and fortunes of all and his descendants. After pursuing above 600 years the fleeting Caesars of Constantinople and Germany, they now descend in the reign of Heraclius on the eastern borders of the Greek monarchy. While the state was exhausted by the Persian War and the church was distracted by the Nestorian and Monophysite sects, Mohammed, with the sword in one hand and the Quran in the other, erected his throne on the ruins of Christianity and of Rome. The genius of the Arabian prophet, the manners of his nation, and the spirit of his religion involved the causes of the decline and fall of the Eastern Empire, and our eyes are curiously intent on one of the most memorable revolutions which have impressed a new and lasting character on the nations of the globe. In the vacant space between Persia, Syria, Egypt, and Ethiopia, the Arabian Peninsula may be conceived as a triangle of spacious but irregular dimensions. From the northern point of Belize on the Euphrates, a line of 1,500 miles is terminated by the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb and the land of frankincense. About half this length may be allowed for the middle breadth from east to west, from Bassora to Suez, from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea. The sides of the triangle are gradually enlarged, and the southern basis presents a front of 1,000 miles to the Indian Ocean. The entire surface of the peninsula exceeds, in a fourfold proportion, that of Germany or France. But the far greater part has been justly stigmatized with the epithets of the stony and the sandy. Even the wilds of Tartary are decked by the hand of nature with lofty trees and luxuriant herbage, and the lonesome traveller derives a sort of comfort and society from the presence of vegetable life. But in the dreary waste of Arabia, a boundless level of sand is intersected by sharp and naked mountains, and the face of the desert, without shade or shelter, is scorched by the direct and intense rays of a tropical sun. Instead of refreshing breezes, the winds, particularly from the southwest, diffuse a noxious and even deadly vapor. The hillocks of sand, which they alternately raise and scatter, are compared to the billows of the ocean, and whole caravans, whole armies, have been lost and buried in the whirlwind. The common benefits of water are an object of desire and contest, and such is the scarcity of wood that some art is requisite to preserve and propagate the element of fire. Arabia is destitute of navigable rivers which fertilize the soil and convey its produce to the adjacent regions. The torrents that fall from the hills are imbibed by the thirsty earth. The rare and hardy plants, the tamarind or the acacia, that strike their roots into the clefts of the rocks, are nourished by the dews of the night. A scanty supply of rain is collected in cisterns and aqueducts. The wells and springs are the secret treasure of the desert, and the pilgrim of Mecca, after many a dry and sultry march, is disgusted by the taste of the waters which have rolled over a bed of sulphur or salt. Such is the general and genuine picture of the climate of Arabia. The experience of evil enhances the value of any local or partial enjoyments. A shady grove, a green pasture, a stream of fresh water are sufficient to attract a colony of sedentary Arabs to the fortunate spots which can afford food and refreshment to themselves and their cattle, and which encourage their industry in the cultivation of the palm tree and the vine. The high lands that border on the Indian Ocean are distinguished by their superior plenty of wood and water. The air is more temperate, the fruits are more delicious, the animals and the human race more numerous. The fertility of the soil invites and rewards the toil of the husbandman, and the peculiar gifts of frankincense and coffee have attracted, in different ages, the merchants of the world. If it be compared with the rest of the peninsula, this sequestered region may truly deserve the appellation of the happy, and the splendid colouring of fancy and fiction has been suggested by contrast and countenanced by distance. It was for this earthly paradise that nature had reserved her choicest favours and her most curious workmanship. The incompatible blessings of luxury and innocence were ascribed to the natives. The soil was impregnated with gold and gems, and both the land and sea were taught to exhale the odours of aromatic sweets. This division of the sandy, the stony, and the happy, so familiar to the Greeks and Latins, is unknown to the Arabians themselves, and it is singular enough that a country whose language and inhabitants have ever been the same should scarcely retain a vestige of its ancient geography. The maritime districts of Bahrain and Oman are opposite to the realm of Persia. The kingdom of Yemen displays the limit, or at least the situation, of Arabia Felix. The name of Neged is extended over the inland space, and the birth of Mohammed has illustrated the province of Hejaz along the coast of the Red Sea. The measure of population is regulated by the means of subsistence, and the inhabitants of this vast peninsula might be outnumbered by the subjects of a fertile and industrious province. Along the shores of the Persian Gulf, of the ocean, and even of the Red Sea, the ichthyophagi, or fish-eaters, continue to wander in quest of their precarious food. In this primitive and abject state, which ill deserves the name of society, the human brute, without arts or laws, almost without sense or language, is poorly distinguished from the rest of the animal creation. Generations and ages might roll away in silent oblivion, and the helpless savage was restrained from multiplying his race by the wants and pursuits which confined his existence to the narrow margin of the seacoast. But in an early period of antiquity, the great body of the Arabs had emerged from this scene of misery, and as the naked wilderness could not maintain a people of hunters, they rose at once to the more secure and plentiful condition of the pastoral life. The same life is uniformly pursued by the roving tribes of the desert, and in the portrait of the modern Bedouins we may trace the features of their ancestors, who in the age of Moses or Muhammad dwelt under similar tents and conducted their horses and camels and sheep to the same springs and the same pastures. Our toil is lessened, and our wealth is increased by our dominion over the useful animals, and the Arabian shepherd had acquired the absolute possession of a faithful friend and a laborious slave. Arabia, in the opinion of the naturalist, is the genuine and original country of the horse. The climate most propitious, not indeed to the size, but to the spirit and swiftness of that generous animal. The merit of the Barb, the Spanish, and the English breed is derived from a mixture of Arabian blood. The Bedouins preserve, with superstitious care, the honors and the memory of the purest race. The males are sold at a high price, but the females are seldom alienated. And the birth of a noble foal was esteemed among the tribes as a subject of joy and mutual congratulation. These horses are educated in the tents among the children of the Arabs with a tender familiarity which trains them in the habits of gentleness and attachment. They are accustomed only to walk and to gallop. Their sensations are not blunted by the incessant abuse of the spur and the whip. Their powers are reserved for the moments of flight and pursuit. But no sooner do they feel the touch of the hand or the stirrup, then they dart away with the swiftness of the wind, and if their friend be dismounted in the rapid career, they instantly stop till he has recovered his seat. In the sands of Africa and Arabia, the camel is a sacred and precious gift. That strong and patient beast of burden can perform, without eating or drinking, a journey of several days, and a reservoir of fresh water is preserved in a large bag. A fifth stomach of the animal whose body is imprinted with the marks of servitude. The larger breed is capable of transporting a weight of 1,000 pounds, and the dromedary, of a lighter and more active frame, outstrips the fleetest courser in the race. Alive or dead, almost every part of the camel is serviceable to man. Her milk is plentiful and nutritious. The young and tender flesh has the taste of veal. A valuable salt is extracted from the urine. The dung supplies the deficiency of fuel. And the long hair, which falls each year and is renewed, is coarsely manufactured into the garments, the furniture, and the tents of the Bedouins. In the rainy seasons, they consume the rare and insufficient herbage of the desert. During the heats of summer and the scarcity of winter, they remove their encampments to the seacoast, the hills of Yemen, or the neighborhood of the Euphrates, and have often extorted the dangerous license of visiting the banks of the Nile and the villages of Syria and Palestine. The life of a wandering Arab is a life of danger and distress. And though sometimes by rapine or exchange he may appropriate the fruits of industry, a private citizen in Europe is in the possession of more solid and pleasing luxury than the proudest emir who marches in the field at the head of 10,000 horse. Yet an essential difference may be found between the hordes of Scythia and the Arabian tribes. Since many of the latter were collected into towns and employed in the labors of trade and agriculture, a part of their time and industry was still devoted to the management of their cattle. They mingled in peace and war with their brethren of the desert. The Bedouins derived from their useful intercourse some supply of their wants and some rudiments of art and knowledge. Among the 42 cities of Arabia, enumerated by Abulfida, the most ancient and populous were situated in the happy Yemen. The towers of Sana'a and the marvelous reservoir of Merab were constructed by the kings of the Homerites, but their profane luster was eclipsed by the prophetic glories of Medina and Mecca near the Red Sea, and at the distance from each other of 270 miles. The last of these holy places was known to the Greeks under the name of Makaraba, and the termination of the word is expressive of its greatness, which has not indeed in the most flourishing period exceeded the size and populousness of Marseille. Some latent motive, perhaps of superstition, must have impelled the founders in the choice of a most unpromising situation. They erected their habitations of mud or stone in a plain about 2 miles long and 1 mile broad at the foot of 3 barren mountains. The soil is a rock. The water, even of the holy well of Zemzem, is bitter or brackish. The pastures are remote from the city, and grapes are transported about 70 miles from the gardens of Taif. The fame and spirit of the Qurayshites, who reigned in Mecca, were conspicuous among the Arabian tribes, but their ungrateful soil refused the labors of agriculture, and their position was favorable to the enterprises of trade. By the seaport of Gedda, at the distance only of 40 miles, they maintained an easy correspondence with Abyssinia, and that Christian kingdom afforded the first refuge to the disciples of Muhammad. The treasures of Africa were conveyed over the peninsula to Gerha, or Katif, in the province of Bahrain, a city built, as it is said, of rock salt by the Chaldean exiles, and from thence, with the native pearls of the Persian Gulf, they were floated on rafts to the mouth of the Euphrates. Mecca is placed almost at an equal distance, a month's journey, between Yemen on the right and Syria on the left hand. The former was the winter, the latter the summer station of her caravans, and their seasonable arrival relieved the ships of India from the tedious and troublesome navigation of the Red Sea. In the markets of Sana'a and Merab, in the harbors of Oman and Aden,
The camels of the Qurayshites were laden with a precious cargo of aromatics. A supply of corn and manufactures was purchased in the fairs of Bostra and Damascus. The lucrative exchange diffused plenty and riches in the streets of Mecca. Then the noblest of her sons united the love of arms with the profession of merchandise. The perpetual independence of the Arabs has been the theme of praise among strangers and natives. And the arts of controversy transform this singular event into a prophecy and a miracle in favor of the posterity of Ismail. Some exceptions that can neither be dismissed nor eluded render this mode of reasoning as indiscreet as it is superfluous. The kingdom of Yemen has been successively subdued by the Abyssinians, the Persians, the sultans of Egypt, and the Turks. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina have repeatedly bowed under a Scythian tyrant, and the Roman province of Arabia embraced the peculiar wilderness in which Ismail and his sons must have pitched their tents in the face of their brethren. Yet these exceptions are temporary or local. The body of the nation has escaped the yoke of the most powerful monarchies. The arms of Sesostris and Cyrus, of Pompey and Trajan, could never achieve the conquest of Arabia. The present sovereign of the Turks may exercise a shadow of jurisdiction, but his pride is reduced to solicit the friendship of a people whom it is dangerous to provoke and fruitless to attack. The obvious causes of their freedom are inscribed on the character and country of the Arabs. Many ages before Muhammad, their intrepid valor had been severely felt by their neighbors in offensive and defensive war. The patient and active virtues of a soldier are insensibly nursed in the habits and discipline of a pastoral life. The care of the sheep and camels is abandoned to the women of the tribe, but the martial youth under the banner of the emir is ever on horseback and in the field to practice the exercise of the bow, the javelin, and the scimitar. The long memory of their independence is the firmest pledge of its perpetuity, and succeeding generations are animated to prove their descent and to maintain their inheritance. Their domestic feuds are suspended on the approach of a common enemy, and in their last hostilities against the Turks, the caravan of Mecca was attacked and pillaged by 40,000 of the Confederates. When they advance to battle, the hope of victory is in the front. In the rear, the assurance of a retreat. Their horses and camels, who in 8 or 10 days can perform a march of 400 or 500 miles, disappear before the conqueror. The secret waters of the desert elude his search, and his victorious troops are consumed with thirst, hunger, and fatigue in the pursuit of an invisible foe who scorns his efforts and safely reposes in the heart of the burning solitude. The arms and deserts of the Bedouins are not only the safeguards of their own freedom, but the barriers also of the happy Arabia, whose inhabitants, remote from war, are innervated by the luxury of the soil and climate. The legions of Augustus melted away in disease and lassitude, and it is only by naval power that the reduction of Yemen has been successfully attempted. When Muhammad erected his holy standard, that kingdom was a province of the Persian Empire. Yet 7 princes of the Homerites still reigned in the mountains, and the vice-regent of Khosroes was tempted to forget his distant country and his unfortunate master. The historians of the age of Justinian represent the state